This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It's time for our Friday pitch in, and I'm once again broadcasting live from my basement. Today, we'll get some much needed information from our workforce development reporter, Justin Hicks, about the troubles people have had applying for unemployment benefits and what you should do if you're still confused about how to proceed. He also has some interesting information about the new federal allowance for self-employed people to receive benefits and what that means for states who have had to scramble to figure out how to implement them. And later, the Indiana Division of the Salvation Army has had to shift its efforts amid the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also had to shift its approach to incorporate social distancing. And it's also meant that many of their usual volunteers can't help. I'll talk with their COVID-19 incident commander about what they're doing and how they're handling it. But first, we'll start, as we always do on Fridays, with a roundup of the state's biggest headlines with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going, Matt?
How's it going with you? It's been another busy week. Do you have the latest numbers?
Yeah. So as of 11:59 p.m., we've got nearly 7,000 confirmed cases and more than 35,000 deaths. And unfortunately, Indiana hit a bit of a milestone today as we reported our 300th death from the State Department of Health. So for comparison's sake, last week we had about 3,500 confirmed cases and 102 deaths, with only 17,000 folks tested.
Wow. And didn't we cross the 200 mark earlier this week?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Yeah. And now.
And a lot of that is because of the increase in tests, right? But it's also because of how the virus is progressing in our population.
Yeah. So what about testing? We're up to how many per day?
We are up to about a maximum capacity of 3,700 tests per day. But that is between state and private labs, and the state hopes to increase that to more than 6,000 tests per day as more private labs are coming online. But when you compare Indiana to some of our closest neighbors, we're testing fewer people per 100,000 residents than all of our neighboring states and most of the U.S. as a whole.
Oh, my goodness. So the governor's been giving daily briefings at 2:30 every single day. And he expanded the stay-at-home order.
Yeah.
What have been the details on that?
Yeah. So he expanded the stay-at-home order for about 2 weeks. It now runs this version of it expires on April 20th, though it is more than likely that it will be extended again. And he said in his press conference last Friday that he really wanted to stick with 2 weeks as opposed to the public health emergency declaration that runs through May 4th, mostly because he wanted the state to be more nimble to respond to some of the issues that are coming up with folks staying at home, with getting resources to folks. And so he said during that press conference that the best way to do that was to only extend it for 2 weeks, even recognizing that this is the first of many extensions that we are likely looking at.
But there were some changes that came with this week's extension. What were those?
Yeah. So the biggest change was enforcement of the stay-at-home order. So previously, the stay-at-home order kind of lacked teeth when it came to shutting down businesses that were non-essential. While the original stay-at-home order gave the Indiana State Department of Health a little bit more gusto to shut down restaurants that were still serving folks in-house, it didn't have that same authority for non-essential businesses. And so this now does. Between the state's alcohol and tobacco department, IOSHA, the Indiana Office of Safety and Health Administration, I think that's the numbers or names. Now it has the authority to issue warnings. It has the ability to, in the worst case scenario, shut down businesses that are ignoring the stay-at-home order. It also includes churches in that, not in different but similar ways. So the stay-at-home order limits gatherings to no more than 10 people, allowing people to maintain social distancing of 6 feet. Though some churches throughout the state have really flouted that restriction in recent weeks. He, at a press conference yesterday, that was just yesterday, said that churches should, even as we enter Easter weekend for a lot of Christians who celebrate in the state, even as we enter that, you know, churches need to be cognizant of that. And during that press conference yesterday, he said he hopes that law enforcement won't have to break up church services violating the stay-at-home order, which kind of unsaid says they might have to.
Well, that's been a news story around the country as some defiant churches have continued to hold services. But I haven't heard about much of that happening in Indiana, have we?
No, not so far. There have been a number of violations, but nothing as extreme as some of the stories that we've heard from across the country, especially with the dire consequences from some of those other services across the country. I believe the one in Georgia we're seeing deaths because of that gathering. So thankfully, we haven't seen that nearly as much in Indiana.
What about other changes? I've heard some changes that came to state parks.
Yeah. So state parks are closing campgrounds, which means that they're still open. You can still go to the trails, especially for your mental health in particular.
Indeed.
But make sure to respect social distancing if you want to keep these open. For example, the Hoosier National Forest is now limiting visitors to help maintain distance, which is something that a lot of stores are doing across the state as well in order to help allow them to stay open.
I was at McCormick's Creek State Park on Sunday, and for the most part, it seemed like people were they had social distancing in mind, but there were a number of groups that were there that were not, that were, you know, they were all together. Now, they may have all been in the same household, but it did definitely seem like if you were to look at that from a distance, you might have some questions. Of course, we don't know the circumstances, but yes, if you are going, do not ruin it for everybody else. What happened with the Indiana Supreme Court this week?
Yeah, it's still got to do with COVID, unfortunately. The Indiana Supreme Court actually rejected a petition from the ACLU of Indiana to release inmates at higher risk for the virus in jails and prisons. So the ACLU last week said, hey, this is going to be a real problem for folks, and we should release them those who don't pose a threat to their community and are at higher risk for the virus. And they suggested that could apply to people awaiting trial who don't pose a risk to the community and offenders whose sentences could be reduced or suspended. So the court responded this week and said the ACLU is asking it to extend its authority too far, that the power to release inmates or suspend sentences really rests with trial courts and county officials. And earlier this week, in addition to all of that, all three branches of state government took steps to empower local officials to release inmates. Now, that being said, at least one county has already announced that they will not be releasing inmates. Vandenberg County Sheriff Dave Wedding says while they're monitoring inmates at the county jail closely, right now they're not considering releasing anyone just because of the outbreak. On the flip side of that, in St. Joseph County, they've been making moves to reduce the number of people in their jail, including not making as many immediate arrests for misdemeanors and nonviolent crimes. But there is an additional factor to consider here as well. This week, we are up to 10 inmates and 20 employees who have tested positive for COVID-19 within the Indiana Department of Correction system. We've got a couple of reporters across the state, including Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper, looking into that aspect of it as well. But there's a lot of squishiness, no matter your opinions of the system or not, that are raising concerns across multiple arenas.
And something happened in education today, right?
Yeah. So everyone will have more information from Jeannie Lindsay on this later tonight. But the governor signed an executive order that essentially gives schools two options for teacher evaluations. Either schools can use last year's evaluation or they can conduct a new one without test and observation data. And they have to if a teacher is on a remediation plan or doesn't have an evaluation from the previous year. Now, that's absolutely the Cliff Notes version Jeannie gave me before I went on air, but she'll have a much better explanation for All Things Considered.
Okay. And we're still using the Indiana 2022 way, right, with regard to COVID-19?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, this week, we sent folks who are already a part of the 2022 way a resource guide that Justin Hicks and I put together to help people connect to unemployment, understand the system a little bit better, and reach out for additional questions. So you can join if you text elections to 73224. That's the Indiana 2022 way. We're still covering COVID. We're still doing all this, but we are also hitting on the elections as we barrel toward our new June 2nd primary.
And you guys did a great webinar, or what was it, a Facebook Live with Justin, answering a lot of different questions?
Yeah, I was also a panelist for that. It was weird.
That's right. And weren't there some cameos from, what was it, Justin's cat or dog?
Dog, Charlotte, who is the goodest girl in the whole wide world. yeah, she made a brief cameo while Justin was explaining the subtle intricacies of being self-employed and trying to apply for unemployment insurance. Charlotte decided to, rise up and provide her own vibrato to his words.
And indeed, I'm broadcasting live from my basement here on the southeast side of Indianapolis, and I've got my two dogs in here with me. Thankfully, they're being quiet right now. And if you yourself are interested in any of the furry friends of our Indiana Public Broadcasting reporting team, I believe we're getting some fun tweets from Brandon Smith and his new kitten that's in the household right now.
Yes. Brandon's cat might be the highlight of my year. And like one of my cousins found out that he and his wife are having a baby girl. And that's great. And I'm very excited for them. but Tuna is what is keeping all of us sane together in this.
Well, what about you, Lauren? Are you, you're still coming into the office? Are you coming in every single day?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah. And you're coming to a very empty building, right?
Yes, but you know what? We've got work to do, and we're making it happen.
Lauren Chapman is Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer. She's still coming in. Lauren, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, over 100,000 Hoosiers have filed for unemployment in just the last few weeks, and the rules just keep changing. We'll get the latest from our workforce development reporter, Justin Hicks. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Last week alone, more than 6.5 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits as jobless claims continue to rise due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, that doesn't even take into account the people who've been denied due to technicalities or those who can't get through because of bandwidth and website issues. Here to help us understand what's happening in Indiana is our very busy Indiana Public Broadcasting Workforce Development reporter, Justin Hicks. Hi, Justin.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. I am busy, but maybe not as busy as you. It's been a busy month for you. So much has changed. So many people are out of work. And what are the latest numbers from the Department of Labor?
Yeah, so the latest numbers that we're seeing for Indiana are 133,639. I'll add an asterisk to that. That is the number of people who have applied for unemployment insurance claims in the last week. That actually does include people who are maybe found out to be not eligible, or maybe even sometimes people double file accidentally. And so that doesn't necessarily count that number. If you go to that number, that is more like, I want to say it's 102,000 or so. So it's a little bit lower, but still, it's a lot of people.
There are a lot of factors at play here. You said the difference is in the sum of over 25,000 people who have applied and not gotten benefits. Mm-hmm. What exactly makes someone eligible or ineligible for unemployment benefits?
That is a great question, because that is constantly changing. Not constantly, but I will say, maybe not constantly, but it has changed a lot lately. So basically, It used to be in almost every single state, you had to be kind of ready and able and willing to take a job and kind of get back out in the workforce as quickly as you could in order to receive unemployment benefits. Of course, that has all been changed now because even if you want to get back out in the workforce, you can't. You have to stay at home. So federal laws have come down from Congress in Washington, and those are trickling down to the state level. Which sounds great, and in theory would be great if all that magically happened overnight. But the catch is, all of the unemployment systems are handled and processed at the state level. And even more than states, it's actually territories as well. So we actually have 53 different unemployment systems running simultaneously in America, and that's not managed by the federal government. So when the federal government says, hey, you know what, we're going to make some changes to unemployment, that's a great thing, but it means that 53 different systems suddenly have to figure out how to make their citizens happy overnight.
Oh, so it changes from state to state, potentially. And you've been doing so much reporting on this. We can't thank you enough for everything you're digging up, including the fact that a lot of the traditional barriers to unemployment insurance have been removed by the federal government, exactly what we're talking about. So what are some more examples of what's no longer a disqualifier?
Sure. So in the past, if you were sick, if you were ill, you would not be eligible for unemployment. Now, if you are ill due to COVID-19, you can receive unemployment benefits. Another big one is if you had to stay home because maybe your kid's school is closed and you have, you know, a five-year-old, and that five-year-old can't be left at home alone, obviously. If you have to quit work to take care of your children and your children are home e-learning and all that kind of stuff, then that now qualifies as well for unemployment insurance. In addition to that, this is a little bit separate from unemployment insurance per se. If you are still working, there is now paid sick leave, 2 weeks of paid sick leave mandated by the federal government for COVID-19 related purposes, and also paid family leave. So, I mean, things that people, you know, and it's, by the way, it's fascinating to see because tons of labor unions and labor rights activists have been rallying for years and decades to secure, you know, basic, you know, universal paid sick leave and things like that. And all it took was this crisis to make those things happen overnight. So that's been kind of fascinating to watch, actually, from a labor law perspective.
What about self-employed people? You put out some reporting on this earlier this week. I want to make sure that we touch on some of it. What does federal law say about self-employed people getting benefits?
Yeah, so this is a big one. And if I could scream anything from the rooftops, if we could if we could somehow put one piece of knowledge into Hoosiers' brains right now, it would be this. So the Federal CARES Act does open up the doors on the federal level for self-employed gig workers, independent contractors to be eligible for this new type of unemployment assistance called the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. However, remember that whole bit about the states are the ones who actually implement the programs?
Oh, no.
So what's happening right now is that self-employed people have never been eligible for unemployment. And the way that a self-employed person reports their wages is very different from how someone who works for a company reports their wages, because you don't have a W-2, right? So the state is having to figure out, okay, what forms are we going to use to prove someone's income in order to get them the right amount of benefits? So long story short is, yes, self-employed people on the federal level, the door is open for you to get benefits. However, huge asterisk, the state is not set up for that yet. So if you apply right now in Indiana for unemployment benefits and you are self-employed, you will get denied. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just because the system has not been set up yet for you. And DWD, the Department of Workforce Development, is trying, I totally believe this, they're trying as quickly as they can, because if I'm getting this question a million times, they're getting it 5 million times, you know?
Okay, so if self-employed people want to get the benefits, what I'm hearing is they go on and they get denied, and then what?
That's a great question. Typically, if you get denied for a claim, you can do this this process called an appeal process. And the appeal process is actually it's a court process. It's like any other court case. You appeal the decision. It goes up to a judge. You have to explain to a judge, here's why I think I should get this, yada, yada, yada. But of course, you know, no judge in their right mind wants to hear 10,000 self-employed workers explain a very, you know, easy situation, you know, they just check off boxes. So it doesn't seem like appealing is probably the best decision, because you're going to clog up that appeals process for people who actually really do have interesting, complicated, unique situations. So for right now, if you get denied, if you're self-employed, you apply and you get denied, probably the best thing to do is just hang on to that denial letter and wait. Because Fred Payne, the commissioner of the DWD, he said that they are going to try to create this new system to automatically import those people into the new system. So good for you. You've already input a lot of information to the system, but it has to be imported into the new system once that gets created.
So, okay, we're talking with Justin Hicks, our workforce development reporter, about unemployment benefits. And so what I guess it sounds like they want people to go online and put everything in and get denied just so they're there. And just so they, when they do figure it out, they'll at least have everybody's information.
Yeah, kind of. I've asked a couple people this. I've asked them, do you want people to go and get denied? And I haven't heard a firm yes or a firm no, per se. The message that I've heard is, if you do get denied, we're going to save that information, and that might make it a little bit faster for you in the future. Yeah, but I wouldn't say they necessarily want you to go ahead and apply. It just kind of, it might help you out a little bit in the future.
I'm going to ask the annoying timeline question. Do we have any idea when that'll get figured out? Are we talking weeks? Are we talking a month?
No idea. So I think I heard last week. I heard weeks last week. So we might be a week closer now. The situation is, I mean, this is, it's literally a new piece of software, if there's another way to explain it. And, you know, as we all know, software doesn't get created overnight. So even though this piece of software, you know, we'll probably borrow a lot of elements from the piece of software that is used for normal unemployment insurance, it's still a different program and it's a different beast. So who knows? It could be weeks. I would probably go with weeks at this point.
All right. Well, speaking of traditional unemployment, let's get into that and some questions that are being asked about that. So, all right. My own wife was furloughed from her job and she completed everything online. And when she was done, she said, I think I did everything right. And she, for the record, is a lot smarter than me. And so I can only imagine how I would fare if I were in the same situation.
Sure.
And it seems like some of the people who can't get in can figure it out just fine, but are just having bad luck with bandwidth because too many people are all doing this at once. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A lot of people are doing this at once. It is clogging up the system. So honestly, me and another reporter, we went onto the application ourselves just to see what the questions were and just to make sure that we could guide people through these questions if we needed to. And the lesson that we learned from personal experience, just keep hitting refresh. And I promise, I think I did it around noon on a Tuesday, and the maximum number of refreshes I had to hit was about 9. But after a while, you do get through it. It's not that bad, but just, you know, find that refresh button and get used to hitting it.
That is, I mean, for now, I guess that's a solution, but that is,
yeah.
I can't imagine that being sustainable and also frustrating. Nothing frustrates me more than when technology doesn't work, and I know I'm not the only one.
And I think, I mean, just to add, though, that I think it really does speak to sort of how unprecedented this is. Essentially, and I've heard this from a lot of different states as well, you know, these systems were just not built to handle this many people at once, because I don't think anyone really anticipated hundreds of thousands of people applying all at once. So, you know, I will add, too, that it's not just our state. In other states, I think the systems, from what I've heard, have maybe completely crashed. Ours is slow, but it hasn't crashed. So there is a silver lining in the cloud, I guess.
So for people who have successfully applied and are eligible, do we know when that money is going to start making its way into people's bank accounts?
Yeah. So the Department of Workforce Development says the average time to wait is 21 days or 3 weeks, depending on how you want to look at it, from the time that you click submit on your application in the time that you start to get a, you know, a nice parcel of money in your bank account. That's average, though. So remember, some people might take a little bit longer. If you have any sort of issues with your claim, it will for sure take longer. So remember that. And I'm sure there are probably people who don't have any issues, and it might be taking 22, 23 days. Remember, statistically, an average is the number of days divided by the number of people. So, you know, 21 days is a nice average.
Okay, so they could see money within around 21 days, again, average. What if there is a problem?
So, yeah, so a lot of people are also getting these little error messages on their claims. From what I'm hearing, they look at little yellow triangles. It's kind of like a little hazard sign that you might see on the road. And my understanding from DWD is that this most commonly occurs if the employer has not given your employment information to the state. So each business quarter, every 3 months, every company in Indiana who has an employee, whether it's one employee or 5,000 employees, has to tell the state, here's our payroll records, here's everyone's Social Security numbers, here's their names, and here's how much we paid them, just for unemployment insurance reasons, right? If your employer maybe has old records or hasn't updated that, then that's a very common occurrence where you'll get that little yellow triangle. So DWD is then going to reach out to your employer and say, hey, this person applied for unemployment benefits. They said they worked for you. Can you just verify that you did pay them X amount per month so that we can just verify that amount real quickly? According to DWD, the employer has up to 13 days to get back to them. If the employer does not get back to them in 13 days, my understanding is that the claim will move forward, you know, at no fault to the person who applies. But of course, that's going to increase the amount of time that you have to wait. And of course, you can also imagine, too, as many employers have laid everyone off, I'm not entirely sure even, you know, who is getting that email from DWD saying, hey, you know, is this person your employee? How much should they make? We just want to verify. So that's an interesting point, too.
Can you tell me about this Department of Workforce Development Q&A that happened on Wednesday? What other kinds of things were people asking about?
Yeah, so the Q&A on Wednesday, to be quite honest, I think most of the questions were things that they had pulled from their kind of frequently asked questions page. I will say, actually, what was more fascinating about that than anything might have been the ticker. You know, on the Facebook Live, you get that little ticker on the side where people put their comments.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are self-employed, very frustrated, saying, when can I apply? Other people posting, you know, probably a quarter of the questions were actually like very specific questions about people's claims. I mean, there's a lot of questions out there. And typically, I think, you know, DWD normally gets like 2,000 people per week or so. And they're usually able to help people with those questions individually. But right now, that's just not a reality. Of course, everyone's situation is a little bit different. And that was really coming out in that Q&A.
How many people were on that Q&A? How many people were watching?
I think at peak, I think I saw Facebook said 7,300 or so.
Wow.
I went back and looked at it a little bit later. I think a couple, maybe 100,000 actually watched the video to some degree later on, according to Facebook's metrics. Mm. So
it was, I can't believe this. It was just 2 months ago, almost to the day, that we were unpacking some reporting that you did on Indiana's unemployment offices and the fact that they were underfunded and therefore understaffed, because at that time, just 2 months ago, unemployment was extremely low. It's incredible what can happen in that amount of time. Have you talked to anybody from Work One about how things are going?
Yeah, I have. And actually, it's sort of interesting and nuanced. So there are two pots of money that fund each Work One office. One of those is the WIOA funding, which is what I reported on. And the other pot of money is the Wagner-Peiser Act money. WIOA money goes to people who help you retrain for sort of the new job if your job is just utterly doesn't exist anymore. In this case, so in a typical recession, you're going to see a lot of jobs that just won't exist anymore because companies over, you know, the course of a long recession will just go out of business. We're not entirely sure if that's going to happen in this case. More optimistic economists hope that this is going to be a V-shaped recession, where we skyrocket down and we skyrocket right back up. If that's the case, the WIOA people won't have to do much more because, you know, people are going to go right back to the exact same jobs they had. But if companies, if we start to see companies just going out of business entirely, if we start to see companies go under, then yeah, they'll be busier than ever because they'll be retraining people for new jobs.
Has Work One and other state entities been able to hire people either back or increase their staff in any way to help out?
So the Department of Workforce Development has hired a lot of people on the state level to help out with this call center. I think Fred Payne said they hired 77 people just for the call center alone, and that's internally. In addition to the 77 people, they did a contract with an outside call center to get 100 additional staffers for the call center. By the way, DWD gets a lot of money from the Wagner-Peiser bucket of money, so they're amping up on that end. As far as Work Ones go, all of the re-employment services that Work One offers are currently basically closed because most of those things are done in person. So because of that, the Work Ones haven't really had to do anything. All of the weight has sort of fallen on the shoulders right now of the DWD at the state level.
Justin Hicks is based at WVPE in Elkhart. He's Indiana Public Broadcasting's workforce development reporter, a very important job these days. Justin, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Up next, the Salvation Army has been doing a lot of COVID-19 relief work in Indiana. We'll talk to the guy in charge of it, and we'll ask how they've dealt with the surge of need at a time when many of their volunteers can't even come help. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There's no shortage of companies and organizations stepping up to provide relief to people who need it amid the economic and societal turmoil caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But what if goodwill was your whole business even before the pandemic? Everyone's plans have been disrupted. So how does this impact the good that would have been done under normal circumstances? Here to talk with us is Vinal Lee, lieutenant with the Salvation Army Indiana Division. He's also the incident commander for their COVID-19 disaster response. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I definitely want to talk about everything the Salvation Army's been doing in Indiana amid the pandemic, and it's a lot. But
yeah. This
has really thrown a wrench in your plans for the year. What have you had to cancel or postpone?
Yeah, so there's been a number of things across the state of Indiana that we've had to cancel or postpone, the least of which is the majority of our youth programming. So, you know, during the school year, we run youth development programs that have had to be canceled or at least postponed for now until this pandemic is behind us. And so really, we're missing out on some really great opportunities to impact youth within the state of Indiana. We've had to cancel some senior programming for our older adults. There's just a number of things that here in Indiana we're just unable to do just by the nature of this pandemic.
Are you considering virtual programming of any kind, or does that really fit into how you do things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to a certain degree we've been able to we've heard stories out of Indianapolis and down south and in Madison, Indiana, where the Salvation Army has been connecting with their youth to keep them engaged in what's happening, trying to do some character building. So throughout the school year, the Salvation Army offers what we call character building programs. And so these are life skill programs that have a religious element built into them. And so they've done some what they call character building at home and been meeting virtually in that way. We heard of a Salvation Army that hosted a virtual game of horse to try to keep their basketball team engaged. And so there's ways that we're trying to leverage some of these digital platforms as best as we can. But, you know, as everyone's experiencing it, it's simply just not the same.
Don't you do a big summer camp in Bedford? Is that still on?
Yeah, so it is not on this year. So the summer camp in Bedford, unfortunately, won't have any summer camps happening. So the pool will be closed, the dining room won't open, no kids on the playground. There will be absolutely zero summer camp programming, which I think of for me and what brought me into the Salvation Army was summer camp programming. And to think that, you know, we might have missed an opportunity this year just because we're unable to connect with future leaders of the Salvation Army breaks my heart to a certain degree. But yeah, absolutely. There's no summer camp. Bedford, the camp in Bedford just simply will not open this year.
What kinds of things, though, do kids usually get out of that camp or get to do?
Some of the things that the kids get to do out of that camp, really it runs the spectrum of things. We offer a music camp, which provides music instruction for kids as young as 5, as old as 18. And that's, you know, starting with basic music theory all the way learning brass instruments to sort of more contemporary instruments. And so there's opportunities like that won't happen. This year there was a large sort of outdoor experience camp. So teaching kids wilderness survival, as well as how do you engage appropriately with nature so that we can conserve nature well and not be damaging to the environment that we've been so blessed to have. And so there's opportunities like that, as well as some more age specific. So there's teen camps where kids of the same age get together and just kind of get to share in a summer experience that they might not otherwise have had.
I'm actually just hearing about a concept that you use a lot with your youth programming, the developmental assets framework, the 40 developmental assets. Have you thought about the developmental assets, as long as we're on the subject of youth programming, have you thought about the specific assets that might be most impacted by this pandemic and maybe how that may determine focus areas for youth programming in the near future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as we look at the 40 developmental assets, and those are broken down into two areas. There's internal and external assets. You know, some of those external assets being support, empowerment, boundaries and expectation, and constructive use of time. Right off the top, you know, we see that a lot of those external assets kind of begin to be shifted in a certain way. You know, the support system that our kids had, whether that was at schools or in churches or in summer camps, some of that begins to disappear. Empowerment, do they know that there's a community that values them? Are there resources available to them? You know, those begin to change. Boundaries and expectations. Summer camp is a great opportunity to provide boundaries and expectations to youth. Yeah, I think as we come back into our programming year, we're absolutely going to have to really ramp up these developmental assets. And it's really not simply just so that kids could have assets, but the research is really staggering as far as the more of these assets, the more of these 40 assets that these young people can have, the greater their chances are at avoiding some high risk behavior. So underage drinking, violence, illicit drug use, sexual activity, gambling, eating disorder, school truancy, the list goes on and on. The more of these assets that we can provide our youth, the better chances they have of being a very successful and productive adult. And so as we look at all of this time loss, we've been talking with schools and hearing the phrase brain drain. We think of, you know, sort of the asset drain that's happening in all of this. There will be a huge need for us to come back into this next program year and really focus on and really ramp up assets. And so what we're able to do now in the meantime, as everything has moved digital, is try our best to really focus on those internal assets. So how can we make a commitment to learning? How can we instill positive values, maintain social competencies, and offer a positive identity to our young people? You know, especially commitment to learning. I think the schools have done as best as they can, given the circumstances ahead of them, to move to e-learning. So how do we come alongside that and support while also offering our programs and making sure that kids are engaging their brain as best as they can and working that? And then positive values. How can we maintain a connection to these kids so that it's not just we only care about them when they're in the building, but we care about them when they're in the building and out of building. And so making sure that we're keeping those positive values of caring and equality and social justice and integrity. And the list goes on and on. So for us, as we look and begin to plan for this next year, the 40 developmental assets for us, I think, is going to make the difference as to whether or not this COVID-19 ends up being a loss or an opportunity to really redevelop the way we view programming.
It's a good way to look at it. We're talking with Vinyl Lee, lieutenant with the Salvation Army Indiana Division. He's also the incident commander for their COVID-19 disaster response. And so some of the programs that Salvation Army had been planning have gone away, but some have just shifted. So what exactly have you shifted to address things related to COVID-19?
Absolutely. So some of the things that the Salvation Army has been able to shift to address COVID-19 is a lot of our social services, which I think is really the thing that the Salvation Army may be best known for in our communities all across the state of Indiana, is the way that we serve our diverse communities in diverse ways. And so all across Indiana, you'll find a Salvation Army offering hot meals, providing food pantries. And, as we've been encouraged, rightfully so, to social distance, it's not a great idea to have people congregate in your dining rooms for meals or walk in and out of your food pantries, touching everything and interacting with each other. So we've had to move to a more drive-through model of food pantry or a more to-go style feeding program. And so what we saw yesterday out of Indianapolis, where there's a program in partnership with Sokoa, which is a senior meal program that provides box food for seniors here in Indianapolis. And they were able to drive through the parking lot, a volunteer, they popped their trunk, a volunteer walked out, put the box into their trunk, closed the trunk, and they were able to drive off without ever having to interact or touch one another, and were able to keep that really sanitary. And so we're moving towards, how do we continue to meet these vital needs in our community? People need food. We see that on the disaster relief side of this, our supply chain of food is different than what it's ever been before. It's really difficult to get food. People are experiencing that as they go to the grocery store. So our food pantries are experiencing an increased demand for their resources. So we can't simply just close pantries, and we can't stop our feeding programs because people would go without. But we also don't want to put people in harm's way. So we've adjusted the way that we interact with people and really engage those programs so that we can continue to do this essential service without expanding the harm that's already been done by COVID-19.
I'm always curious about the hierarchy and the structure of the way Salvation Army does things. Your role as incident commander relating to the COVID-19 disaster response, what is it? What have you been doing? How have you been coordinating things?
Absolutely. So I think hierarchy in general is really an interesting animal to study, but especially within the disaster world. So those who may work in the fire service or some sort of emergency profession would be familiar with what they call the incident command structure. And so this is a system, this is a model that is used worldwide to organize in times of disaster. And so the role of the incident commander, and as far as it pertains to disaster response, is to provide leadership and direction to their staff in meeting what we call incident objectives. So we have a set of goals that we're trying to accomplish here, and it's my job as incident commander to begin to develop those goals, provide strategic objectives, and then empower my team to accomplish those. And since I'm the incident commander for the entirety of the state of Indiana, based out of Indianapolis Fountain Square, I've got a really sort of unique or difficult job of trying to provide objectives for as far north as Fort Wayne and as far south as New Harmony. And so there's this wide geographical span that we're trying to provide some oversight and direction for, so that Salvation Army personnel in those communities don't necessarily have to focus on disaster response. They can focus on doing the work that they do so well, and we can focus on getting them resources and helping them recast the way that they administer those programs so they keep people safe. So my job as incident commander is to really think through those things strategically and help equip them with resources, staff, and at times finances to make sure that we truly are living up to our slogan of doing the most good.
I keep seeing the date of March 11th as the turning point relating to the effect that this virus has had on society. It's hard to believe it's only been a month. Do you recall about when the Salvation Army started specifically addressing this, noticing that this would be a big deal and knowing that you'd have to shift things?
Yeah, I think so. This is if we're looking specifically at Indiana, which I think we are. For us, we began establishing this command structure on March 16th. It was our first day that we really began to fully staff this. Now, Salvation Army's noticing trends worldwide and even nationally began to see that there are some things that we're going to have to augment very quickly. So us, around that March 11th and even a little bit before that, we began moving in some communities to a drive-through style and moving meals to go. But the Salvation Army serves in 131 countries. And so we were getting correspondence from our partners worldwide saying that you guys are going to need to quickly adjust what's happening because this isn't simply going to stay contained. And so we knew that we had to begin thinking strategically through how we were going to respond to this in Indiana. And so March 16th is when we began to fully deploy our command team.
So we've talked a little bit about what you've done in central Indiana. So let's branch out a little bit throughout the state. In Lafayette, you actually partnered with the city with some of your efforts. How so?
Absolutely. So in Lafayette, Indiana, the Salvation Army there was called upon by the city to provide support to their sheltering operations. So what the Salvation Army was able to do was we provided them with shelter resources. This is cots, blankets, hygiene products, and they were able to there in Lafayette open up a fully staffed shelter that provides support to. In the beginning, it was those who were homeless. That they were simply trying to get off the street to prevent the spread of COVID getting to them. It quickly kind of morphed into being a quarantine location for homeless who did come back testing positive for COVID-19. So it's been a sort of a flexible shelter to agree, but they've been able to, there in Lafayette, in partnership with the city, create this shelter, this resource that may not have been otherwise possible. And so there in Lafayette, they've got a 40-bed shelter set up, and that's being fully supported by the Salvation Army there in Lafayette.
Is it hard to find volunteers right now with everyone being told to stay home? Have you found that to be the case, or are you flooded with people?
It has been incredibly difficult to find volunteers to come out and serve in this way. The majority of volunteers are faithful volunteers for the Salvation Army all across the state, tend to fall into that high risk category. We have a ton of really committed 60 plus individuals who love the Salvation Army and are so heartbroken that they can't serve at this time. And so we've not found it incredibly easy to be able to find volunteers to serve and to work in areas that we need them. Part of that, I think, is those who could volunteer are deemed essential workers or in that high risk category. So for us, it has been a huge challenge to be able to find volunteers to help support in our communities across Indiana.
Vinyl Lee is a lieutenant with the Salvation Army Indiana Division. He's also the incident commander for their COVID-19 disaster response. Vinyl, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast is out there. Subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts. Monday, we'll be talking about the pandemic's impact on the Black community. We'll talk to a panel of guests, including an entrepreneur, an artist, an activist, and a neighborhood organizer about the challenges ahead. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the meantime, I'm Matt Pelser. Have a nice Easter weekend, as nice as you can anyway. Go wash your hands now while you're thinking about it. You really can't overdo it. This is All In.